Let the spirit of the Kennedys
and the magic of the Disney brothers be with you always.
Blood and Business Legacy merch, available now.
Let's run faster,
work harder,
burn brighter
before we're gone.
Order your Blood and Business Legacy merch today.
Trigger warning. Sensitive sexual subjects discussed in today's episode.
In sharing the details of that night with others, I always get the same reaction about President Kennedy's behavior. At first, the response comes in the form of dismay at the president's sinister intentions. "You must see it, Mimi," they say. "You were set up. He was a predator." Then, when I don't agree, the response changes to disappointment in me. Others take the argument a step further. They are not shy about bringing up the R word. Rape, to describe what happened to me. I don't see it that way.
We need to talk about the Kennedy siblings.
Episode 17.
Welcome to Blood and Business.
I'm Bethany.
And I'm Cassie.
Chapter 1.
Everyone has a secret. This is mine.
Once Upon a Secret, My Hidden Affair with JFK by Mimi Alford.
Or as JFK knew her,
Mimi Beardsley. In the summer of 1962, I was 19 years old, working as an intern in the White House press office. During that summer, and for the next year and a half until his tragic death in November 1963, I had an intimate, prolonged relationship with President John F. Kennedy. I kept this secret with near religious discipline for more than 40 years, confiding only in a handful of people, including my first husband. I never told my parents or my children. I assumed it would stay my secret until I died. It didn't. And here is going to be something very familiar to all of you. In May of 2003, the historian Robert Dallek published An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963. Buried in one paragraph on page 476 was a passage from an 18-page oral history that had been conducted in 1964 by a former White House aide, Barbara Gamarekian. The oral history had been recently released along with other long-sealed documents at the JFK Presidential Library in Boston. Dalek had seized upon a particularly juicy tidbit. Here's what it said.
Kennedy's womanizing had, of course, always been a form of amusement, but now it gave him a release from unprecedented daily tensions. Kennedy had affairs with several women, including Pamela Turner, Jackie's press secretary, Mary Pino Meyer, Ben Bradley's sister-in-law, two White House secretaries playfully dubbed Fiddle and Faddle, Judith Campbell Exner, whose connections to mob figures like Sam Giancana made her the object of FBI scrutiny, and a, quote, tall, slender, beautiful 19-year-old college sophomore and White House intern who had worked in the press office during two summers. She, quote, had no skills, a member of the press staff recalled. She couldn't type.
And that is Mimi. So she's like almost 60 years old by this point. She's walking down the street one day. She lives in New York City. And on one of the little like bodega newsstands is
JFK had a Monica. Historian says Kennedy carried on with White House intern 19.
Headline. However, the person who did the interview, Barbara, could not remember her name. So it was just, I'm scared that it's all coming out, but like not yet.
Mm-hmm.
Then,
like, people don't know for sure it's me.
Then she gets an email. And then I sat down and checked my email. A friend had sent me a message that contained a link to a daily news story. I clicked on it, not knowing what it was, because she had actually just seen JFK had a Monica, but she didn't see the rest of the headline.
That it was like, it was a 19-year-old.
Yeah, a White House intern, 19, all that. She didn't like know that they knew that until she opens this email from her friend. with the headline, quote,
"Fun and games with Mimi in the White House."
Her straight up name.
He had sent it to me, he said, because of the funny coincidence of our names. For the first time in my life, I knew what people meant when they said they had the wind knocked out of them. I went cold. I quickly closed my door. By the way, she works at a church. This was the moment I had feared my entire adult life. I tried not to panic. I took a deep breath and mentally checked off all of the things that weren't in the article. The Daily News didn't know where I lived. They hadn't contacted any of my friends. They hadn't reached out to people from my White House days. They didn't have my picture. If they had known more about me, they would have included it, right? And they certainly would have tracked me down for a comment. None of that had happened. The day after it ran, I arrived at work to find a woman sitting outside my office.
At the church.
Yep. She introduced herself as Celeste Katz, a reporter from the Daily News, and wanted to confirm that I was the Mimi in the previous day's story. There was nowhere to hide and no point in denying it. "Yes, I am," I said.
"Mimi breaks her silence,"
read the headline the next morning.
Oh my gosh, I'm kind of shocked that she admitted it.
I know.
I feel like immediately. I would be in such shock that I would just, because you've been trying to hide it for so long.
Yeah.
Your
gut reaction would be like, no.
No. Panic.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, yes, it's me.
At this point in my life, I was 60 years old and divorced, living quietly by myself in an Upper East Side apartment a few blocks from Central Park. In the early 90s, 4 decades out of dropping out of college, I'd gone back and earned my bachelor's degree at the age of 51. I was a lifelong athlete and a devoted marathoner who'd spent many pre-dawn hours circling the Central Park Reservoir and enjoying my solitude. When the news broke, it broke everywhere. Not only in New York, but across the United States and in Europe, too. Here, unfortunately, was my 15 minutes of fame. Quote,
"From Monica to Mimi."
Quote,
"Mimi, only God knows the heart."
Quote,
"JFK and the church lady."
I was mocked by one of my favorite writers, Nora Ephron, on the op-ed page of the New York Times. I hate that. It's so sad. Interview requests poured in. My answering machine full of messages from Katie Couric, Larry King, Diane Sawyer, and of course, the National Enquirer, which actually slipped an envelope of $20 bills under my apartment door, which I gave to the church. Weekly magazines deluged me with letters, quote,
"Dear Miss Fonestock."
They all began, quote,
"I apologize for the intrusion. I know this isn't an easy time for you, but..."
And then they got to the point. A college acquaintance provided some comfort, quote,
"Please remember that all of this is this week's news,"
she wrote.
Aww.
"It will go away. It's just that JFK is like Elvis. We all think that we know him, and we always want to hear more."
That's nice.
Yeah. She turned down all of the media requests. Quote, "I had spent the last 40 years in fear of being hunted down, found out, exposed. And now, that moment had come. But it was unexpectedly liberating. A calmness came over me. As the media storm hit full force, I realized I could handle it. That I had nothing to be ashamed of. I was through with hiding. To the throngs of reporters camped out in front of my apartment building, I handed out a simple statement. Quote,
"From June 1962 to November 1963, I was involved in a sexual relationship with President Kennedy. For the last 41 years, it is a subject I have not discussed. In view of the recent media coverage, I have now discussed the relationship with my children and my family, and they are completely supportive."
And then I said nothing more.
Aww.
And that was in 2003. This book didn't come out until 2012, so she definitely sat on it for a minute. I am no longer the sheltered 19-year-old Mimi Beardsley, who entered into a relationship with the most powerful man in the world. Nor am I the scared, emotionally crippled Mimi Fonestock, who spent a lifetime living with and struggling to overcome the consequences of that relationship. I am Mimi Alford, and I do not regret what I did. I was young and I was swept away, and I cannot change that fact. It's been almost 10 years since my secret was revealed to the world, and I've spent a lot of time in the intervening years thinking about this tender episode in my life. But since then, the happiness and contentment I have come to know as Mimi Alford have freed me and taught me the importance of taking control of my story. At first, I wrote letters, never mailed, to my oldest granddaughter to, quote,
set the record straight. Dearest Emma,
I began,
I have a story I want to tell you because someday when you are older, there's a chance you might come across my name in a book about an American president. I want you to know the facts.
But there was so much more to the story than just getting the facts down for the record. Living with a secret had stunted me emotionally, and I realize now that my letters were only tentative steps at understanding. Taking complete control would demand intense self-reflection and not just beginning and ending with my time at the White House. It begins on a train to Washington, D.C. It was a hot, muggy Sunday in Trenton, New Jersey, June 1962. I was not yet a college sophomore, not yet 20 years old, and here I was on my way to Washington, D.C., having landed the plummiest of summer jobs, an internship in the White House. The next morning, I would be walking through the West Gate and going to work in the press office of the Kennedy administration. I had no idea what the job would entail or whom I would be working with. For that matter, I still only had the foggiest idea of how the internship had fallen into my lap in the first place. I would soon learn that most people at my level had secured their positions by pulling strings or calling in favors, even for the lowest paid internships. Some interns had family connections or parents who were big party donors. That wasn't me. There were also those who had such a profound passion for politics, they had landed their jobs through sheer force of will. That wasn't the case with me either. I hadn't even applied for this internship.
What?
I know. Like many young people in the early 1960s, however, I was not immune to the star power and renewed sense of purpose that the dynamic president from Massachusetts represented. He was younger than my father by 12 years. He had a beautiful young wife who matched him step for step in style and glamour, and it was she, Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy, who, in a roundabout way, had gotten me this job in the first place. Let me explain. So here's how it went. Jackie had gone to Miss Porter's. We talked about that in the Bouvier episodes for sure. Miss Porter's was in Farmington, Connecticut. It was an upper-class boarding school for girls, and Jackie, the inquiring photographer, was a writer on the Salma Gundy, which was the student newspaper. Jackie was class of 1947. Well, then fast forward to Mimi went to the same school, wrote on the same newspaper. So she got the idea. She's like, oh my gosh, Jackie is a Farmington girl. So I should write her a letter and see if I can get an interview for her old alma mater. Like she wanted to do an interview article in the Salma Gundy on Jackie being the first lady.
Yeah.
A month after the inauguration, the school's headmaster helped her draft the letter. They shipped it off to the White House, and then they waited and waited, waited, didn't hear anything back. And then finally, on March 10th, a cream-colored envelope engraved with the White House in dark blue landed in my mailbox. With grace and kindness, Miss Baldridge, which is one of Jackie's secretaries, cited the First Lady's hectic schedule and the, quote,
a lineup of well over 100 correspondents and journalists awaiting the opportunity for a personal interview with her.
Which very few of them ever got. That was the bad news. The good news was that Miss Baldridge asked if I'd be interested in coming to the White House and interviewing her about Mrs. Kennedy.
Okay.
So she was...
And who's Mrs. Baldridge or whatever?
Jackie's social secretary and chief of staff.
Okay.
Which also herself was a Miss Porter alum.
Okay.
So she was like, well, I'm also an alum and we can talk about the alum Jackie in the Salma Gundy newspaper. It all makes sense.
Yes.
This wasn't your standard brush off. I was being invited to the White House. If not to speak with the First Lady, then to report on the next best thing. A fellow ancient, which is what they called alums at Miss Porter's, who was scheduled for the last week in March 1961 during her spring break. So her spring break is going to be very exciting.
Mimi's.
Yes, Mimi's spring break. Let's see. She flew down through LaGuardia Airport. The next morning, I walked through the White House East Gate a few minutes before my 11 o'clock appointment. The Kennedy administration had moved in just 7 weeks earlier. So she walks in and it's like still boxes, stacks of paper. It's like move-in time, you know? My guide that day would be Priscilla Fiddle Ware. Yet another Miss Porter's alum who had graduated in 1958, the year before I arrived. Fiddle, a childhood nickname because she couldn't pronounce Priscilla, was something of a legend at school because of her job at the White House. But I'd never met her before. All I knew was that she and her roommate, Jill Cohen,
Faddle,
later to be called Faddle, were inseparable. Jill, predictably dubbed Faddle, worked in the press office. Fiddle was an assistant to Evelyn Lincoln, the president's personal secretary. Fiddle led me from Miss Baldrige's office in the East Wing, and I was immediately impressed and a little intimidated by her confidence and professionalism, as if no space was off limits to her. As we walked, she mentioned that because of spring break, the White House was jammed with tourist groups and friends of friends. This would make it very difficult to get across to the West Wing. So she took me on the scenic route through a maze of underground tunnels and hidden stairwells, feeling her way along. We emerged in the West Wing, just outside the Cabinet Room. Through a window, I could see Miss Baldrige guiding a group of children into the Rose Garden, which is the one that JFK would like walk out and all the little kids, Caroline and everybody at Jackie's school would run school. Up to yeah. Jack. Tish, which is Miss Baldrige, motioned for me to stand next to her among the kids. The two of us towered over them as we waited for the president to emerge. Then the doors of the Oval Office swung open and out into the Rose Garden came the President of the United States.
And she had no idea that she was going to meet him or see him or anything. She was literally going for just someone who went to the school and yeah.
Jackie's
worked as
social secretary. So Jackie doesn't have time for her, but out comes the President of the United States. That is so like Jack and Jackie, you know?
Yeah.
Jackie's unavailable. Mm-hmm. But Jack,
present and accounted for.
Of course, I was nervous and starstruck. What high school student wouldn't be? This is spring break of our senior year?
Yes.
Okay. I was curious to see the real person compared to what I had read or imagined. President Kennedy was taller, thinner, more handsome in person than he looked in photographs. He was patient and charming with the children, shaking hands and talking to each one, crouching down to their level. He was, after all, a politician. Although this was probably just one of many meetings and ceremonial functions on the schedule for that day for the president, he was also keenly aware that the few seconds those children had in his presence would be something they'd remember forever.
Oh.
When my turn came to shake hands with him, Miss Baldrige stepped in. She introduced me by name and mentioned that I was a student reporter.
"Where do you go to school?"
he asked, taking my hand in his.
"Miss Porter's school, sir,"
I managed to say. The whole thing felt unreal. A smile of recognition.
"What brings you here?"
he asked.
"I'm writing an article for our school paper, the Selma Gundy, about the First Lady. Where are you going to college next year? Wheaton or Hollins? Well, it's nice to see you. Good luck. Thank you, Mr. President."
And he was gone. The story I wrote about my experience,
Ancients in the White House,
filled almost the entire issue of the Selma Gundy and was a great success around campus. I was proud. Even more so after I sent the issue to Tish Baldrige. So when the call came from the White House press office a year later, it seemed to make at least a little sense.
So she's the interview, her spring break of her senior year of high school. Then she has summer, a full year of college, and then her summer
the
break
second
between
summer, yeah.
freshman and sophomore year of
college
is when she goes and interns at the White House.
Got it. Tish must have remembered me and my interest in journalism, awarded me a few bonus points for being a part of the Farmington Sisterhood, and suggested me for the open position. I'm speculating here because I never asked or was told why I was offered the internship. I only knew that I couldn't say no.
What?
which was great for me, but less so for my father. This sudden opportunity meant he had to make an unpleasant phone call, pulling me out of the summer job that he'd arranged for me as a receptionist in training at a New York law firm. I felt terrible about this and about going back on my word, but he was only too glad to do it. Quote,
"If it's a choice between interning in the White House and training to be a receptionist in Manhattan,"
he said,
"it's no contest."
I was on my way to Washington. Isn't that a little freaking creepy and a little freaking
weird? But there's
weird?
No way. Like, no. He does not remember her from a year ago. It's a little weird. And at first I'm thinking the worst case scenario that Jack saw her, thought she was hot, then is like pulling her into the whole freaking shenanigans. But no, there's no way. Because, I'm sorry, but she's not that.
She's not.
Rememberable.
No.
She's not Judith Campbell Exner. She's not Marilyn Monroe.
No.
She looks like a normal person. They did not have this like amazing connection.
No.
There's no way that he remembered her and then calls her back over a year later.
Mm-mm. No, she was.
This was definitely a like.
Either Fiddle or Tish. They needed somebody. They needed to hire somebody. They were like, oh, remember her?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just because they already had a personal connection. She's like, not wanting to work with some lunatic, you know?
Yeah.
You want to hire people who you've already had an experience with and you...
Okay.
Like, people don't get hired for their skill as often as they get hired for, I would want to work with you every day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, like, a lot of people can do this job. It's just typing and admin work.
Yeah. Just, are you going to be annoying or...
Yeah. And so even Fiddle is probably like, ooh, if I hire someone really good who's... really agreeable and like nice to work with, then that'll look good on me.
Yeah.
And then
it was definitely that. It was not Jack.
No, I don't think so either. Especially the whole year later thing. Yeah. Like that is not Jack fashion.
No.
So here is more context of who Mimi was, where she came from, what her childhood was like. I grew up in Eastern New Jersey in a rambling colonial farmhouse, one of the oldest in Middletown Township. The main house dated to 1781.
How cool.
It had 14 rooms.
Oh.
Including 7 fireplaces, a pine paneled library, and a ballroom.
Rich.
My mother named our house Still Pond Farm. Quote,
"No more moving," she said.
You know you're rich when you name your house. But all in all, she had a really good childhood.
Yeah. She said, all the WASPy and preppy boxes were checked, and yet I didn't feel growing up that we were excessively privileged with 7 fireplaces and 14 bedrooms.
That just like screams, I grew up in a bubble.
It was just very, very, very sheltered, perfect. Nobody was dramatic. Nobody talked about anything. Mm-hmm. She didn't feel like she could talk to her mom about stuff. She didn't feel like she could talk to her older sister about stuff. And that set her up a little bit. We inhabited a self-contained world where nearly every phase of our lives was mapped out for us, defined by the expectations of our so-called class. We heeded the implicit agreement that politics or religion was never openly discussed for fear of causing offense. Money was a taboo topic. It was distasteful to mention how much one made or spent on anything. And wealth was definitely not something to be flaunted. It was assumed that everyone we knew was a Republican and shared the same Protestant faith.
So just like
the opposite of the Skagel family.
Literally the opposite. That's exactly what I was thinking of.
We were constantly reminded that self-reliance was the greatest virtue.
Well.
So here's what's interesting. I don't know if it's just Mimi's perspective or if it is just how the White House was back then. Or if it was weirdly unique to her situation. But the White House and everyone in it back then were just so much more accessible. In all, there were 9 people in the press office, 7 of us jammed into the tight open space, and Pierre, who luxuriated in a roomy office with 2 doors, one of which opened into our room and another of which opened into a hallway that led to the Oval Office. I later learned from Pierre's memoir,
With Kennedy,
that some evenings the president would venture into our quarters from the Oval Office to snoop around our desks. Always looking for a bit of gossip. Mm-hmm. The president had a habit of borrowing books and documents, which Pierre would then have to retrieve from his night table and bring back to whoever's desk. The atmosphere was remarkably open and casual in such tight quarters. It had to be for anything to get done. On my second day, I received a promotion. Barbara, the one who had done the interview from the archives, put me in charge of the press photography file. She'd fallen behind and badly needed help. Quote,
I'm so busy that I haven't had time to sort out the files and they're a mess. Could you do that?
I didn't hesitate to say yes. I couldn't get over the fact that everyone, from the front gate guards to the travel office people, seemed to know me by name, even though we had never been formally introduced. It was as if I had been awarded membership into an elite club without ever having to go through the initiation process. Even as an intern, I was immediately made to feel part of the team. Looking back on it now, that was the most extraordinary feeling I can recall from those first days. I felt like I belonged. Do you remember what happened on her fourth day on the job?
She got a phone call?
Yeah. So 2 days in, she's like, wow, everyone knows my name. I freaking belong in this elite club. Fourth day in, she gets two invitations. One to the pool. The second to the president's private residence. Now, something I didn't read in the main episode is that after she hung up when Dave called her initially about swimming at lunch, quote, I stared at the handset for a few seconds before I placed it back in its cradle, befuddled by the invitation. Then I looked at Jill's desk, hoping for guidance. Is this normal? I wanted to ask. Does this happen all the time? But she wasn't there. I thought about my mom and dad and how I should be keeping a list of all the amazing things I was seeing so I could tell them later. I thought about how lucky I was to be here. I pictured their astonishment when I would call them that evening to describe my White House swim. I never did make that call. Speaking of Dave Powers, no one was more loyal to the president or more in his thrall. When Kennedy and Powers toured the West Wing together for the first time, Powers compared the moment to, quote,
being Alice in Wonderland.
Above all, Dave Powers' job was to make the president happy. As we reached the entrance to the pool, Fiddle and Jill suddenly appeared by my side. They seemed to be veterans of this swimming ritual, which instantly put me at ease. I had not seen Fiddle since she had given me a tour of the White House the year before. I was hoping that she and I would become great friends when I arrived for my internship, but she was 4 years older, practically a generational divide among college-age girls like us. And Jill, Fiddle, had a desk directly across from Mimi's. Their desks like touched and faced each other. Jill is the one that Mimi was hoping she could ask like about the invitation to the pool. Is this normal? But Fiddle, she hadn't seen in a year.
Okay.
I followed the girls into the dressing room where, as Dave promised, there were more than a dozen bathing suits hanging on hooks. They were plain one-piece cotton suits of varying sizes with boxer shorts and gathered fabric at the bust line. I wondered to whom they belonged or if they were left there as public property to be used whenever someone had an inclination to get some exercise. Fiddle and Jill didn't waste any time wondering. They just started stripping down and leaping into suits. Their enthusiasm was contagious, so I reached for the first suit at hand. The fit wasn't as snug as I would have liked, but it wasn't in danger of falling off either. The White House pool, long since covered over to create today's press office and briefing room, was a perfect oasis designed to simulate a tropical island. The walls on three sides of the pool were painted floor to ceiling with palm trees swaying in the breeze and puffy sailboats moving through the turquoise water. The fourth wall was mirrored, so the space felt vast. As I walked past the mirror toward the edge, I stole a glance at myself in the borrowed suit and felt a wave of relief. I may not have had a lot of curves, but at least I had good posture and my long legs played up my height and slimness. Dave Powers joined in as well. Sort of. He took off his shoes, rolled up his pant leg, and sat on the edge of the pool, dangling his feet in the water. I boldly dove in, eager to feel the refreshing splash of cool water on my body and to join Fiddle and Jill, who were already floating around, chatting and giggling. I remember treading water with Fiddle and Jill, asking them whether the sandwiches and drinks left by the side of the pool were meant for us, when President Kennedy walked in. He was standing above the three of us in the pool, handsome, tan, and in a suit and tie.
Mind if I join you?
He asked. Fiddle, ever confident, said,
Our pleasure, Mr. President.
Off he went into the dressing room, only to reemerge minutes later in a pair of dark swimming trunks. He was remarkably fit for a 45-year-old man. Fiddle and Jill didn't seem the least bit surprised to see him, which confirmed to me that this midday swim was a usual event for them, and hence, perhaps not as strange as I had thought. The president slid into the pool and floated up to me.
"It's Mimi, isn't it?"
he said.
"Yes, sir. Mimi Beardsley. And you're in the press office this summer, right?" "Yes, sir, I am,"
I replied.
"Is Pierre treating you all right?" "Yes, Mr. President. He seems very nice. What's he given you to do?"
I told him about collecting the wire stories and answering the phone and sorting out the press photographs.
"I hope that will be interesting,"
he said.
"You have a good place to stay for the summer?" "Yes, sir, in Georgetown. My roommate works for the State Department." "Well, nice to see you, Mimi,"
he said, and he floated away toward Fiddle and Jill. I spent a few more minutes circling the pool, not knowing exactly what to do, and swam over and chatted for a while with Dave. Then the president climbed out of the water, which Dave took as our signal that the swim was over. I grabbed a quick bite from the food tray since the pool escapade had become my lunch break, changed out of the wetsuit, and returned to my desk. There, in the tight quarters of the press office, the effect of what I had just done began to dawn on me. I felt self-conscious, as if everyone knew where I'd been and was staring at me with stern disapproval. It wasn't exactly hard to figure out. My hair was wet and smelled of chlorine. It must have been obvious that I had been swimming, but none of my coworkers said a thing. I wasn't about to bring it up either. Who would believe it and what would they think? And then this is where she's like, "Oh my gosh, he knows my name. He knows my name." And she said, "Now here I was, the summer intern moving to the front of the line, leapfrogging career woman who had labored long and hard on the presidential campaign to get a sought after job at the White House. So I kept my head down and my mouth shut and went about my work as if nothing had happened."
And like, what are you going to do? Talk to people you've known for 3 days?
Yeah.
About it?
No.
No. And the person that she did trust enough to ask was there with her.
Uh-huh.
Jill.
Yeah. So then, while her hair is still damp, she gets the second call from Dave Powers.
That same day?
The same day.
I forgot that it was the exact same day.
Yep.
Yeah, because she would like to have gone home and changed her dress and freshened
up. Exactly.
Wow. Well.
Yeah. So the elevator door opens. She's on the second floor. And she realizes, I'm standing in the family residence. I wanted to pause for a moment to take it all in, but Dave kept going, leading me to an area known as the West Sitting Hall. It was lined with bookshelves and comfortable couches and chairs in front of an enormous half-moon window opening out on the western sky. There I found Fiddle and Jill in conversation with a man named Kenny O'Donnell.
"Have a daiquiri,"
Dave said, lifting a frosted pitcher from the coffee table and pouring me a glass. I hesitated. I was not much of a drinker. That's the other thing that we don't realize is the culture differences.
Yeah. 19 was a full-grown
adult.
An adult. Like, you're about to start popping out all them babies.
Yeah.
Immediately.
You can drink. You can sign up to go to war. You can...
Yeah, because you even said in episode 16 or with Jean, talking about her.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Ethel,
if,
and
you like, didn't, if you weren't
have
engaged
at
by 17,
you were about to be like an old spinster and you needed to like get on it, lock it down.
Yeah. So
17.
Like,
people aren't like haven't even had their first boyfriend now at 17, you know?
No.
And
yeah,
they're engaged.
True. This White House world is like a slight bit more career driven, but this is barely 1960. I mean, it's basically still the 1950s culture wise.
Yeah, slightly more career driven because Jackie was super career driven for back then.
Mm-hmm.
And she got married at 25, I think. And
yeah.
That was old. Like,
really
she was
old.
Like the last, like her little sister, who's 4 years younger than her,
right,
got married before her. All of her friends were married.
But the general public of America and this debutante culture that Mimi came from was definitely still 50s housewife. You grow up, you graduate high school, maybe you go to college and you get married and you have kids. So yeah, she's not much of a drinker at 19.
"Thanks,"
I said, accepting the glass with a polite sip.
"Welcome to the White House staff,"
Dave said, raising his glass, almost making it sound as if this cocktail hour was staged solely to honor my arrival at the White House.
"It's great to be here,"
I managed to say. I drank down the daiquiri and, feeling a little more relaxed, did not protest when Dave filled my glass again. I may not have been an experienced drinker, but I knew enough to eat some food. I plunked myself down in a chair by the puffed cheese hors d'oeuvres on the coffee table and listened in on what Jill and Faddle were discussing with Dave and Kenny. Among the more interesting tidbits, I overheard the news that Mrs. Kennedy and the two children, 4-year-old Caroline and 18-month-old John John, had left for Glenora. That is the Virginia countryside home that Jackie always went to, like, ride horses and stuff.
Okay.
Suddenly, everyone rose to their feet as if Hail the Chief had begun to play, and into the room walked President Kennedy. I'm not sure why I was surprised to see him for the second time that day. After all, he lived here. But I had gotten so caught up in my daiquiri, it slipped my mind that he might show up. The president greeted us, took off his suit jacket, sat down on the couch, and put his feet up on a coffee table. I could feel the center of gravity in the room shift immediately. We stopped talking among ourselves and turned ever so slightly toward the president, making him the center of attention. Jackie's so used to this his whole life. He was no doubt aware of this. It must have happened to him dozens of times a day for his entire life. I savored the idea that I had been included in the president's most trusted White House circle, those with whom he chose to relax and take a break from the relentless responsibilities of the day. Honestly, it was thrilling. It felt as if someone had pinned a medal on me, or that I had been tapped to join the most prestigious club at school. But I was so uncomfortable. Despite the good cheer in the room and the overwhelming glamour of being on the second floor of the White House, a space very few people ever got to see, I knew I didn't belong to this group. I hadn't done anything to earn it. I didn't know if I should stay or go. I kept my eye on Fiddle and Jill and determined I would leave when they did. Then the president rose from the couch and walked over to the chair I was sitting in.
Would you like a tour of the residence, Mimi?
A private tour of the White House from the President of the United States. This was an extraordinary invitation.
Oh, yeah. You said in the main episode that she had heard about Jackie's renovations and was dying to see. She just is so
starstruck.
Young. And also, they didn't really talk about this kind of stuff back then.
No.
Like, we're so paranoid.
Oh, yeah. Freaking.
They were not.
The Weinstein, like,
yeah, Me Too movement has happened. No. Nothing even close to that.
No. As I stood up, the daiquiris went immediately to my head.
Oh.
I looked around, tipsy, expecting the entire group to join us for the tour. But no one else moved.
See, and it's like already too late, and you've already said yes, and you like feel a little weird, but you like don't really know what's going
and
on.
And that feels super weird, but then she's like, of course not, I told myself. They're always up here. They know every room by heart.
Mm.
They don't need a tour.
Yep.
President Kennedy was already leaving the room and I followed after him as if pulled by a magnet. He opened the first door along the hallway, explaining that it had once been a guest bedroom, which Mrs. Kennedy had converted into the family dining room. Standing with the president in the doorway, I tried to take in the newly installed antique wallpaper panels decorated with scenes of the American Revolution. But I got a sense that the president had done this tour many times before and was in no mood to linger. He then led me across the central hall and opened another door, stepping aside for me to enter.
This is Mrs. Kennedy's bedroom,
he said. That was odd, I thought. Her bedroom? Where did he sleep? It was a beautiful room, decorated with a light powder blue with floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking the south lawn. The bed, with a draped canopy, was really two beds, a hard mattress for the president because of his back, and a softer one for the first lady. There was a sitting area in front of the fireplace with a small white couch. Together, we looked out the window in the fading June sun.
Beautiful light, isn't it?
He said. I agreed. He walked me through the personal memorabilia in the room, a pastel of Caroline, a terracotta bust of a young boy. I noticed he was moving closer and closer. I could feel his breath on my neck. He put his hand on my shoulder.
This is a very private room, he said.
The next thing I knew, he was standing in front of me, his face inches away, his eyes staring directly into mine. This is really hard, guys. It's really hard to read, so just...
It's just so freaking creepy.
Bear with me, guys. The first time I read this, I couldn't say any of it out loud. So then I just handed it to Bethany and made her read it.
Yeah.
He placed both hands on my shoulders and guided me toward the edge of the bed. I laid on my elbows, frozen halfway between sitting up and lying on my back. Slowly, he unbuttoned the top of my shirt dress and touched my breasts. Then he reached up between my legs and started to pull off my underwear. I couldn't believe what was happening. But more, I couldn't believe what I did next. I finished unbuttoning my shirt dress and let it fall off my shoulders. He pulled down his pants and then he was above me. He paused briefly when he felt some physical resistance.
"Haven't you done this before?"
he asked.
"No,"
I said.
"Are you okay?"
he asked.
"Yes,"
I said, and he resumed, but more gently.
"Are you okay?"
he kept saying. I nodded, propped up on my elbows. After he finished and hitched up his pants, he smiled at me and pointed to a door in the corner.
"There's the bathroom if you need it," he said.
Like, what the crap?
I gathered my underwear off the floor and my dress off the bed. I was still wearing my bra, but nothing else as I walked across the room to the bathroom. When I came back, he was no longer in the bedroom.
"I'm out here,"
he called from outside the West Sitting Hall, where our evening had begun. I walked out to join him. He was still sitting on a sofa, and I looked around to see if anyone else was there, but the residence was empty. It was just the two of us.
It's just so manipulative.
I was in shock. He, on the other hand, was matter-of-fact and acted as if what had just occurred was the most natural thing in the world.
"Would you like something to eat?"
he said.
"The kitchen's right there." "No, thank you, Mr. President,"
I replied. What I really wanted to do was leave, and he must have sensed that. He asked where I lived, made a phone call, and then explained that a car would pick me up at the South Portico entrance. He showed me to the private elevator.
"Good night, Mimi,"
he said as the door opened.
"I hope you're okay." "I'm fine, Mr. President."
"I hope you're okay." Like, what in the world? He just keeps, like, asking her. Like, he thinks she's going to tell the truth.
Yeah, literally. That's the freaking thing.
He just is so...
Is he so stupid or not? Like, is he such in a bubble of, like, he's always had autonomy and power and doesn't understand not having it? Or is he just like, "Well, I asked." Like...
I definitely think that because of the way that his sisters were and his mom was, there was no one in his family that would
do something that they weren't comfortable with.
Yes.
That's like, true.
No one in his world.
Pat said no. Like, Pat was like, "I'm not doing freaking weird stuff with you." Rose said no more sex.
Literally, they all, none of them were people pleasing, compliant.
The girl, like, in the restaurant,
meek and
he's
mild.
Like, "Come on, let's go to the motel. There's a motel right down the road." And she's like, "No." And he's like, "Fine then, suit yourself," and walked away.
Like, I really think that he just thought that she was going to be honest with him. And in his mind, he's like, "I keep checking." I think he was really...
Bubble boy.
But I don't understand how he can be so that way. And then Bobby is, like, knows boundaries.
Bobby didn't grow up like Jack did. Bobby had nurturing of his mother.
Weird upbringing. Jack had such a weird upbringing. But also, the siblings that Jack was smashed with were the most honest siblings as well. Kick never would have done something that she didn't want to do.
No. In fact, what she would do... is let John White brush her hair and cuddle her and read to her.
Read her children's books. So,
and
what's going on with
that? Was the extent of that.
The rubber ducks and the children's books. I'm not exactly sure. But
Eunice would have been coming out swinging.
Yeah.
Eunice would have tackled
said,
and punched
was
them.
Was too honest. Eunice said things that people didn't want to hear. She was so honest. Joe Jr. was confident and honest and he was kind, but he... would have never done something that he didn't want to do.
They just each had intrinsic self-worth that was, like, built up in them from their parents. That was all they knew was, "I am important. I am worthy.
I have a voice.
I know what's best. I am wise."
Yeah, Joe and Rose were that way. So it's just like, I mean, even with Lem, he was like, "Oh, you like me? Well, I don't like boys, but do you want to be my friend?" Like, he was just so honest and so...
Yeah. You just say what you want.
Yeah. And, like, things weren't weird to him. That should have been really weird for a normal kid.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think most people would become best friends and do sleepovers and all of that with their gay best friend that they know likes them.
Yeah.
And Jack was just like, not. Whatever, this is fine. Like, this is great. Like, he just didn't care. He was, like, innocent in a weird, twisted way.
Mm-hmm.
And then Joe Sr. is his freaking dad, and he's so inappropriate with women. And that was modeled for him. So in his mind, he's like, I'm respectful. I ask over and over and over again.
Yeah. The thing is, tell me the truth. Is it wrong? Was it a bad situation? 100%, 100%. Did Jack know that? I doubt it.
The setup is really, really weird. It's like the actual happening wasn't as weird as the like...
The Dave Powers acting all, this is normal and happy-go-lucky. And the slow, like, it's like grooming.
Yeah.
Within one day.
Within one day. They just literally manipulated her into that. That is
very... But it's like, so then you think about it like that and it's like, dude, you're a psycho creep. But then all of them,
even Jill.
Jill and Faddle, they basically recruited her.
It's her fourth day. She's 19 years old.
And also,
they show up at the pool with her, act like it's no big deal. They know what's going to happen.
For sure. But in hindsight, also, if they were the ones who got her the job, who said like, oh, let's get her that girl. Like, I wonder if Jack was like, do you know any other girls
that would like to come sleep with me?
I don't know.
Ew.
No, just that just would want to
come sleep with me.
Yeah.
And then Dave Powers is like, I'll set it up for you.
Oh,
bro.
Yeah. Dave Powers, I don't freaking doubt that at all. Then like, you look at it from the other side and it's like, okay, you invite all these random people. And whoever says yes, whoever keeps saying yes and keeps showing up, you invite them to the next thing.
They're just down for it.
If they say yes or no. Right.
Yeah. If they didn't want to, they just wouldn't come.
Like all the other girls in the press office.
Or they
who didn't go.
Yes.
Swimming.
Yeah.
Or went swimming and then was like, that was definitely weird. I'm not
down for this.
Like, into it. The list of people who have had sex with JFK and who had affairs with JFK is so small.
Yeah.
Especially in the White House. There's what did we mention? 5 names?
Yeah.
So it's not like they're just churning through dozens of
that's true. Yeah,
vulnerable
not,
women.
Yeah. Jack's not literally sleeping with anyone who will.
And they haven't practiced. He is sleeping with anyone who will sleep with him, but they haven't practiced that often. I think they're just asking people, and the people who say yes, and the people who say no. And Mimi kept saying yes, and then we'll hear what Mimi has to say about it, okay?
Oh, it's just such a bad situation. Like, I do not think that Jack wanted to have sex with people that did not want to have sex with him.
We have documentation and examples of people saying no and people saying yes. We don't have anyone saying no and
Jack still
getting a different result.
Yeah.
He engaged in
consensual sex.
Yeah. Which is what Mimi said. She said, I wouldn't say it was making love. I also wouldn't say it was non-consensual. As we drove out of the gate, I thought to myself, I was just up there with the president. I wasn't being wistful or self-congratulatory or smug. I had looked back to assure myself that what had happened had in fact happened, that I wasn't dreaming. I quickly turned back and stared straight ahead as the driver maneuvered through DC traffic. How did I get myself into this position? I reran the scene in the residence, recalling the laughter around the living room and the giddy effect of the daiquiris. I re-examined the impulse behind Dave Powers' suggestion for that lunchtime swim. Had he orchestrated the whole thing to give the president a chance to look me over? And what about Fiddle and Jill? Were they somehow involved as well? At the time, I didn't have the stomach to try to answer those questions. One thing I didn't wonder about is whether I had led him on or in some way seduced him. On the face of it, that was laughable. My skills as a seductress were so non-existent that the thought of intimacy between us didn't occur until after the intimacy had begun. As I say, I was incredibly sheltered and naive. But there's no doubt that up there in the residence, I was the direct object of his skills at persuasion. He was a man adept at and accustomed to getting his way. He had that politician's gift of making you feel that when you were in his company, you were the most important and interesting person in the world. After all, here was a man who just months before had mesmerized the nation with his personal style and glamour, his quick wit, and his elan. All of which makes me wonder if I could have resisted him. It's a germane question, and my honest answer to it is no. When we were in the bedroom, he had maneuvered me so swiftly and unexpectedly and with such authority and strength that short of screaming, I doubt if I could have done anything to thwart his intentions. I don't say this to excuse my passivity at that moment because, frankly, I don't think I need an excuse. I'm not ashamed of what I did. I'm just trying to make sense of it now, 50 years later. I'm also not trying to make excuses for President Kennedy. He was, no doubt, a charmer, a seducer, an insatiable Lothario. As I and everyone else would eventually learn, each in our own time, some more quickly than others. In sharing the details of that night with others, I always get the same reaction about President Kennedy's behavior. At first, the response comes in the form of dismay at the president's sinister intentions.
"You must see it, Mimi,"
they say.
"You were set up. He was a predator."
Then, when I don't agree, the response changes to disappointment in me. Others take the argument a step further. They are not shy about bringing up the R word. Rape, to describe what happened to me. I don't see it that way. That night, in the midst of my shock and confusion, I felt for the first time the thrill of being desired. And the fact that I was being desired by the most famous and powerful man in America only amplified my feelings to the point where resistance was out of the question. That's why I didn't say no to the president. It's the best answer I can give. There was a moment.
She didn't want to say no.
She didn't want to say no.
And neither did Jack. So we're both adults here. We both said yes.
There was a moment right after the president realized I had never had sex before and was in some discomfort, when he became more tender and solicitous, more aware of me, and I actually felt close to him. I wouldn't describe what happened that night as making love, but I wouldn't call it non-consensual either. It's just, if he had had sex with anyone but Jackie almost, this would have been a question. And
for
then
sure.
The fact that she's a 19-year-old intern who was super sheltered her whole life and didn't have the opportunity to even learn how to say no is why it's a huge issue. But like we said, in 1961, when you're Jack freaking Kennedy,
yeah,
it doesn't, he didn't speak that language. He doesn't speak 2023 language.
Mm-mm. No, and would I want to be put in that position?
No.
Would I feel taken advantage of?
Yes. I remember that weekend more for what I didn't do than for what I did. I didn't call my parents. I didn't call my older sister. I didn't see any friends. I didn't talk to my roommate, Wendy, who, thank goodness, was away that weekend. Which isn't to say that I spent the weekend hiding or feeling sorry for myself. When I'm anxious, I organize. So I spent the weekend doing my laundry, cleaning the kitchen, mopping the floor, cleaning the tub, and restocking the refrigerator. I went shopping for a few items to dress up my tiny Spartan bedroom. I went on several solitary walks through Georgetown, losing myself in its maze of beautiful streets. It's odd to me now, almost 50 years later, that I felt this way, that I still hadn't made up my mind about what I'd say if he suggested another afternoon swim or drinks in the residence. Frankly, I couldn't decide what I wanted to do. I couldn't settle my mind. I wasn't revolted or appalled by what had happened, and I wasn't harmed. I was certainly confused. Week two at the White House began calmly enough. I still hadn't seen Fiddle or Jill in the office since my encounter with the president, nor had I heard from Dave Powers. I was keeping my head down, going about my duties on Monday morning when I overheard someone say that the president had returned from Glenora and that Mrs. Kennedy had stayed behind in Virginia. The mere mention of his name jolted me. I sat at my desk, paralyzed, my eyes focused on the phone. What if it rang and it was Dave? How would I deal with that? What would I say? Probably the most accurate description of my state of mind was fascination. Being singled out by the president made me feel special, which was not a feeling I was accustomed to. A story was unfolding in front of me, with me in the starring role. And I was searching for the answer to the universal question. What happens next? I prayed that the phone would not ring. Then the phone rang. It was Dave Powers. And remember from the episode, Mimi believes that in any story, there is a pivotal moment, a turning point in which, if the opposite decision was made, the story would end up quite differently. This is another aspect of it. I didn't know Dave or the president well enough at that point to appreciate that I had a choice, that I could turn down the invitation and all that it implied without repercussion. It wasn't as if Dave would become petulant or vindictive because an intern said no to an afternoon swim with his boss. I would eventually come to know that President Kennedy wouldn't have given my absence from the pool that afternoon more than a second's thought. He might have been momentarily disappointed or puzzled, but then he'd have moved on. He wouldn't have punished me for my decision. He was a kind and thoughtful man, beloved by all the people who worked for him. He had a true grace when he dealt with people. He would have been incapable of telling Dave Powers to deal with me in some punitive way. Hence Evelyn Lincoln still being his secretary. He could be sharp and tough, but he saved such displays of power for people who threatened his presidency or his political agenda, not for people who worked for him. I was no threat to him. She said, at 19, I didn't have the ability to connect the events of the evening into a narrative that made sense, so I focused on the most obvious truth. I wasn't a virgin anymore. It kept echoing in my head. I'm not a virgin anymore. I had always imagined that my first time would be with the man that I loved on my wedding night. I wasn't saving myself out of religious or moral conviction. This belief was simply the conventional and widely accepted ethos among girls my age. And I was as conventional as anyone I knew. But what is important is what I believed at the time about JFK and Dave Powers. I believed that if I said no, my dream of a full-time job at the White House would slip away forever. So not in the first initial interaction, but if there would be a second phone call, what she would say. I would never again be invited into the president's inner circle. I would never again experience the heady feeling of being in the same room with the president.
A no would have been such a decision, a final, like,
I'm giving away that this mystical, wonderful, magical opportunity that nobody gets ever.
Ever. This once in a lifetime chance.
Yeah.
That I get, that nobody gets. And I'm going to say no to that, or I'm going to just keep going with it.
Seeing what happens.
Where it goes.
And if I get uncomfortable, at any time. There you go.
In order to keep the door open, I can't say no.
Yeah. Yes. So even though I cringe now, I understand why that 19-year-old girl said yes to Dave Powers' second invitation. She was on her own for the first time in her life, away from her parents, siblings, home, and school, and she was flattered by the repeat invitation. She was determined to have fun, damn the consequences. That's why I got up from my desk and walked to the pool. Fiddle and Jill were already in the water, circling the president.
She's like, I would have said yes either way, but did I have an option? Not really, but would I have said yes if I did? Yeah. You know?
It's like that.
It's like, do I wish I would have said no? Yes. Would any dimension, any world, any universe I have said no? No. If I was given the opportunity again and I was 19 years old again, would I say yes? Yes. Did I have an option? No.
But what do you mean you know? She wanted to say no? I don't think that she did want to say
no. She wanted herself to have wanted to say no, but she didn't want to say no.
But she doesn't regret it.
Right. So she goes to the pool. Jack barely acknowledges her arrival. She said, I couldn't bring myself to look him in the eye, but I was there in a bathing suit at poolside, wasn't I? What did I think was going to happen? I slid into the pool and floated toward the group. The president now turned in my direction and seemed genuinely happy to see me, but he stuck to banal small talk. He asked me if I had a nice weekend and if I was enjoying my job. Nothing more interesting than that. If he was feeling any remorse or guilt about the last time we were together, he wasn't showing it. This, in hindsight, was shrewd behavior, and no doubt instinctual for someone so naturally attuned to other people. He created such a feeling of normalcy at the pool that I gradually began to relax. The president didn't touch me or treat me differently or do anything improper, which gave me some comfort. Maybe our previous encounter had been a one-time occurrence and it wouldn't happen again. I'm not sure why I believed this, because I'm not sure I can say that I didn't want it to happen again. The truth is, I was deluding myself, behaving like a little girl who protests at a boy's advances but complains even more loudly when he stops. So, when later that afternoon, Dave called again and asked me to come up to the residence after work, I accepted. So, then she goes up.
Stay for supper, Mimi,
the president said.
The kitchen staff always leaves food in the icebox.
I froze.
And have another daiquiri,
he said. Soon, he was leading me into a bedroom he hadn't shown me before. It turned out to be his.
Would you like to take a bath?
He asked, showing me into the bathroom.
You can close the door.
I was in such a state of nerves that a nice warm bath actually sounded relaxing.
Does that sound relaxing?
I'll meet you in my bedroom,
he said, and left me alone. This was the beginning of our affair.
That's so inappropriate to be sleeping with people that you work
with. Has power over.
Yeah, that he has power over. That's so inappropriate.
Here's something funny and interesting about Jack. The president was quite vain. If y'all didn't already catch on, particularly about his hair. During that summer, he would frequently summon me to the Oval Office and ask me to administer a hair treatment before one of his televised press conferences.
What?
Like, he didn't have a hairdresser to freaking do this? Like,
yeah, what in the crud is that? He's
maybe
so
he's
freaking
just,
weird.
He's so weird. I don't know if he's like embarrassed in front of other people. No. They really did have an affair. Like they
weren't, had a relationship.
They weren't just sexual partners.
No.
They had a relationship.
Correct.
In which they took baths and played with rubber ducks. It's like he can't let his guard down with Jackie because she's so impressive and serious all the time. She means a lot to him.
Yeah, and he cares what she thinks about him.
Yes. So he needs someone less important and less, because he was so vain.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he wasn't insecure, but he was very unable to let go in front of other people, you know?
Yeah.
And so with 19-year-old Mimi, when he felt like a choked student, he was like,
this is so
able
casual
to just,
and
yes, breathe.
You're like more of a friend, maybe.
Yes, he didn't love her.
Yeah.
And this was never going to go anywhere. There was never a future in this relationship. And so it didn't matter how it went, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There was like no risk whatsoever. Yeah.
The hair treatments were apparently a daily ritual that originated during the 1960 campaign. So she didn't do all of them. He insisted on using products only from Francis Fox, a company in upstate New York. He liked to lean back in his rocking chair and close his eyes while I massaged some tonic and amber-colored ointment into his scalp. Then I would brush, never comb, it all into place. Sometimes a visitor would walk in while this was going on, and the president would signal for me to continue and talk as his visitor worked away. So he like wasn't embarrassed.
What the crud? That is so weird.
So weird. But she said as the summer went on, she was less and less interested in her job and wanted to spend more and more time in the residential wing.
Wait, but so maybe because, yeah, he wanted to impress Jackie. He couldn't let fully go. And they were in such that battle between
yes.
like power positions.
It was already tense.
It was already tense before it even started.
Yeah.
And then also there was a lot of pain and a lot of anger mm-hmm. there as well because mm-hmm. Jack didn't show up for her and so she was hurt by him.
The stakes were too high with Jackie.
Yeah.
It was all so fragile. You couldn't just let go. Oh my gosh. One afternoon, she was on the boat with George Smathers, Red Fay, Torby, Dave Powers, all these people. Sipping drinks on the upper deck of the boat, and a woman took her aside. I don't know who the woman was, but she was older, like as old as Jack and everybody else.
Mm-hmm. You are too young to be here,
she said.
You're going to regret it. All of a sudden, you'll turn around and you'll be 25 and you won't have a life.
I felt like I had been punched in the gut. How did she know? I summoned up my best Farmington poise and said,
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So she was like, how does she know that I'm having an affair? Yeah. She's like 19 on a boat with a bunch of 45-year-olds and the president clearly doesn't belong. And she's like, how does she know?
Oh, no.
You know, she was that lady was trying to look out for her.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just something going on with Kick and Jack and their childlike behavior.
Yeah, they clearly did not get enough maturing and nurturing in their childhood, clearly. It's like the whole little adult thing. Like Rose expected them to be little adults too soon or something. And they didn't get to be a child.
Yeah.
Probably because Rosemary. So she's leaving her internship. She's leaving DC to go back to college.
Okay.
After her internship, okay?
So this is all just over one summer.
Yes. Well, so she tries to get her mom and dad to just let her stay at the White House. And they were like, we already paid your tuition. You're definitely going to be going to college. So she understood, but wasn't happy. She said, I had experienced a liberating and exhilarating summer. And the thought of going back to Wheaton, a quiet all-girls college with strict rules, was depressing. Also, that's the kind of life she's led up until now.
Yeah, like this, how exciting, fun, freeing.
Which is why she's saying, I couldn't say no.
Why would I ever say no? From, yeah, where I was coming from. It's the same weird alternate timeline fate thing that freaks me out about Kick's ending.
Yes.
She should not have been on that plane. Yes. She should not have been in a relationship with that guy.
She
that
should not
how
be
her life was supposed to go.
In Jack Kennedy's bed, eating a cold chicken salad croissant at 6 p.m. and waking up on a Saturday morning with the president of the United States.
You know at 19 years old in her first summer being an adult. That should not have happened.
When I told the president about my plans about her going to college, he teased me that my return to college was more like abandonment of him. Then he would cue up Nat King Cole's version of Autumn Leaves on the stereo in the residence, making me pay close attention when the lyrics came to,
but I miss you, most of all, my darling, when autumn leaves start to fall.
He had a mushy sentimental streak, and he wasn't afraid to show it. Just before I left, I bought him another copy of that record. I trimmed the cover with leaves I'd collected in the park and gave it to him as a farewell present.
You're going to make me cry,
he said.
I'm not trying to make you cry, Mr. President,
I said.
I'm trying to make sure you remember me. Join us here next week to hear all about JFK's darkest places.
Thank you all for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed it, please give us a review on Apple, rate us on Spotify, and share Blood and Business with a friend or a sibling. If you'd like to support the show, the best way is to become a patron of Blood and Business. You will get bonus content every month, including a monthly bonus episode, interactive main episodes, and behind-the-scenes footage.
To keep up with us day-to-day, you can follow us at Blood and Business on Instagram and TikTok. You can find the link for Instagram, TikTok, and Patreon in the show notes below. Thank you so much for the support, and we will see you back here next week for your regularly scheduled programming on
Blood and Business.